From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what do Michigan voters really want this election year?
And I'm not afraid to come on your show and tell you, there's no public mandate to keep cutting taxes.
We look at the push to unionize Northwestern's student athletes.
If Northwestern is forced to provide lifetime health care for their athletes, Michigan State will have to do it the next day, or else they're going to lose players to Northwestern.
There are lots of questions up in the air in Lansing as lawmakers craft the new state budget.
There's road funding, there's the rainy day fund, there is the money that may or may not be out there for Detroit, and lots of differing views on how you get to a final product.
And we discover what Buffalo can teach Detroit about a waterfront. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. On this upcoming November Election Day, Michigan's voters will have some important decisions to make. We will choose a governor, 38 state senators, and 110 state representatives. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, the Center for Michigan has released a new report that looks at what voters really want from these candidates come November. We're going to hear what the voters are saying. Then later this hour, we ask the question, should college athletes be paid to play the sports? Unionizing college athletics. That story comes up in 15 minutes. But first, state lawmakers right now are waist deep in the big budget. Their mission to iron out differences in what the governor wants and what the House and Senate are willing to give. And it looks like many differing views will add up to plenty of haggling, lots of need for compromise. And it has one state senator quoting Mr. T as Clubber Lang in Rocky III.
What's your prediction for the fight then?
Prediction?
Yes, prediction.
Pain.
Well, let's find out why as we say hello to Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray. So, Kathy, why is Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Roger Kahn quoting Clubber Lang and predicting pain?
What's your prediction for the fight then?
Prediction?
Yes, prediction.
Pain.
Well, let's find out why as we say hello to Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray. So, Kathy, why is Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Roger Kahn quoting Clubber Lang and predicting pain?
Well, it's just going to be a little bit of a tedious process to reach a compromise with the House and with the governor. There's three very different versions of the budget that have been proposed. You know, first the governor sent his out in February, and the House and Senate are actually voting on the budget bills this week. The Senate is taking up some budgets as we speak, and the House will be the full House will be taking their first look later today.
So things are working their way out of their respective appropriations committees, and there's just lots of work to be done to align everybody's view?
Yes, absolutely. There is so many things to consider. There's road funding. There's the rainy day fund. There is the money that may or may not be out there for Detroit, and lots of differing views on how you get to a final product. The House has decided to put lots of money into roads. And I think that that's what they're hearing from their constituents, that they want to see some improvements on these pothole-ridden streets that they're driving on. But as a result, they've cut a lot of money from other budgets as well. The Senate didn't put as much in for roads. They're looking at creating another package of bills outside of the budget that might bring in more revenues for roads. So it's just a different philosophy on how to get to where you want to end up.
And as we look at some of these big differences that exist, as you say, there's certainly how to pay to fix our roads. And I think everybody's in agreement after a bone-jarring spring that we want to get that fixed. Also, tax cuts. What are the differences that we're seeing as far as that question?
Well, both the House and the Senate and the governor have proposed different areas to cut taxes, and the committees in the House and the Senate have passed those out, but they have not been considered by the full chambers. And I think that there is a recognition out there that there might be some higher priorities for the state's budget than returning, you know, some people might look at as insignificant number to residents. An income tax cut would, you know, maybe give somebody $50 to $100 a year. But then there are other people who are saying, hey, you know what, it cost me $900 to fix my tires and rims. So that $100 a year isn't going to make up for that. So the tax cut proposals have definitely lessened in importance to the legislature than coming up with a solution for the roads.
Another area that there definitely seems to be differing viewpoints, film incentives. And we know Governor Snyder's never been a big fan of this.
No, he hasn't, but he has capitulated to a certain extent. He zeroed it out 1 year, but then increased it to $25 million. That year, the Senate came back and said, no, we want $50 million. And he said, okay, he'd give him $50 million. This year, he included $25 million in the budget. The House also included $25 million. The Senate bumped that up to $60 million. Randy Richardville, the Senate Majority Leader, is a big fan of the film incentives. He's got family members who are in the film industry in California and feels like it's an important way to diversify the state's economy. And, you know, we'll kind of see where that comes out. Richardville is term limited. This is his last year in the Senate. So, you know, maybe he'll get this parting gift and get at least a little bit more than the $25 million than the House and the governor are looking at.
All right. So we know that those who hope for life in Michigan's film community have a friend in the Senate Majority Leader.
Yes, absolutely, at least until the end of the year when he has to leave the legislature.
Now, the rainy day fund, there's certainly, it's very, can you help us understand all the different viewpoints on what should be done with the rainy day fund? Who wants what?
Right now, the rainy days fund stands at $580 million, which is, I mean, it got to a point during the latest recession where it was down to like $2 million. Mm. So it's up to $580. The governor would like to see that go up to $700 million. So he's proposed $120 million going into the rainy day fund. The House has approved $100 million for the rainy day fund. The Senate hasn't approved anything. They are looking to fill some different types of holes, and there's some Medicaid reimbursement shortfalls that the Senate wants to backfill. So I think that there'll probably be some injection of money into the rainy day fund. I'm not sure how much it's going to end up being.
In fact, I know your story for the Free Press. You talked to State Rep Rashida Tlaib, who is all for let's get some of that money out into services instead of hiding it. But then one can certainly argue it's good to have that rainy day fund because you don't know when you're going to need it. To realize we were down to nearly just a measly $2 million that was bad.
Well, and plus, if they're looking at money for Detroit, which right now that's being pegged at around $200 million, if they do an upfront lump sum payment right at the start, and where is that money going to come from? Is it going to come just from the state's bottom line? Is it going to come from the rainy day fund? So, I mean, they've got to get it through first, which is going to be a challenge in itself.
Yes, and the tobacco settlement money is a possible source, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The state gets, I think, about $250 million a year in tobacco settlement money, which goes to a variety of different programs. And they could use that, and they were thinking about using that over 20 years. But I think that there's some thinking out there now that this legislature doesn't want to have to obligate future legislatures to appropriate that money to Detroit every year. That's going to be a pretty tough vote 20 years down in the future. So I think that there is some consensus around getting it out of the way now, giving them the money now,
that lump sum,
then being done with it.
And yep. Kevin Orr was getting a lot of FaceTime last week with legislators, and I got the sense, am I correct, that he did the cause some good by that time spent in Lansing?
I think he did. You know, there's certainly going to be some detractors out there who, in no uncertain terms, want to give any more money to Detroit. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's also a feeling out there that, you know, Detroit is the state's largest city, and as long as it stays in bankruptcy, that it's a black eye for the state. And the settlement also wipes out any lawsuits that are against the state right now. And so the state could pay $200 million now or could pay a lot more later if the settlement doesn't happen. So I think that that's the big argument that the governor and supporters of the contribution to the state are making.
And then another area of disagreement, last certainly not least, revenue sharing to communities. And it certainly seems like everybody's got tremendously differing views on how to provide tax revenues to local communities.
Absolutely. And this is where, your local city council people, your mayors, your township supervisors are really bending the ear of lawmakers now. They've taken huge cuts in revenue sharing over the last 10 years, $6 billion in revenue cuts. And so they were hoping to see a little of that money coming back. Well, the governor instituted a program that requires communities to do certain things to qualify for the money. They've got to become more transparent, put their budgets online. They have to consider sharing services with other communities. The local communities hate that. It's become a bureaucratic nightmare for them. So they'd really like to see that program scrapped. And the governor has increased revenue sharing by 3%, but keeps this incentive program in place. The House keeps the program in place, cuts the increase to 1%, and spreads it out over a lot more communities. The Senate kind of scraps the program altogether, and also gets a 1% increase to more communities. So I'm not quite sure where that's. I mean, that was a pet project of Governor Snyder. So I'm not sure if he's going to buy into scrapping. It's called the Economic Vitality Incentive Program, or EVIP. And I'm not sure if he's going to buy into getting rid of that entirely.
But if it gets scrapped, you'll be hearing songs of joy from local officials all over the state, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So what kind of deadline are we looking at, Kathy, as far as what has to happen by when?
Well, I think the budgets are going to be approved by the chambers this week. They'll go into conference committee, and they still have a goal of getting it done by June 1st. Some of the other things that are kind of playing into the picture are some road bills that are being considered out there, as well as this Detroit bankruptcy settlement. So that's I have a feeling that those are going to be dealt with in separate bills rather than the budget. I think you'll see the budget done by the end of May.
Keeping an eye on the budget process in Lansing for us is Kathleen Gray, Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this spring, the National Labor Relations Board made some mighty big headlines when it granted Northwestern University football players permission to unionize if they choose to. That decision opened up a big national debate over whether college athletes should be recognized as school employees. So we wanted to talk with sports commentator and coach John U. Bacon. His most recent book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. And you've seen this coming down the pike for a while, haven't you, John?
I have, and Northwestern was one of the four schools that I focused on, also Michigan State and Notre Dame, but mainly Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, and Northwestern. Mm-hmm. I know Kane Coulter pretty well. He is the quarterback about to graduate who is leading this charge for the unionization process for Northwestern players, even though he'll be gone by then, of course.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I predict that both the fans and the players will sooner or later protest what's going on because the suits are kind of running away with this thing. And I thought I was 5 or 10 years out. It's been 5 or 10 months out. I mean, Michigan now has got a problem selling tickets, it looks like. So the fans, and elsewhere too, not just Michigan, Alabama even, they're starting to protest in their own ways with their checkbooks. And the players, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought this was a few years out. It is a few months out. So that surprised me.
And something you pointed out in your book and also in pieces you've written since this NLRB ruling, this school has treated these kids okay. This is not a reflection, per se, of the administration. It's the system.
Agreed. And Kane has made that very clear, the quarterback who's running this charge. He said, look, Fitzgerald, the head coach there, Pat Fitzgerald, has been great to me. Jim Phillips, the AD, has been great. Morty Shapiro, the president, is in their locker room. He knows those guys, and he's a hotshot economist and so on. Very good guy, very good president. And he made it very clear, Northwestern has been very good to us. It's $65,000 a year for a scholarship per year at Northwestern. They pay retail for that, and they almost always sign up for 5 years at Northwestern. So that adds up pretty fast, obviously. Yeah. They've got a 97% graduation rate. This is not a football factory by any stretch of the imagination. But what he is asking for, Kane Coulter, he's been very smart and very shrewd. They're not asking for money, not at this stage. They're asking for lifetime health care for injuries suffered while representing the university. I have a very hard time arguing against that, as you might imagine. If you bang up your knee at 20, need a fake knee at 50, I don't know how you're not paying for that.
Yeah.
It only seems to make sense. Down the road, they might also ask for, I think, and they should, a 5-year, 4 or 5-year guaranteed graduation scholarship. Right now, fans don't realize this, but you are allowed to give 1-year scholarships. So if you get injured or I don't like the way you're playing, I can yank it at any point. They didn't even allow to give multi-year scholarships until 2 years ago, and Northwestern, to its credit, right away signed up their players for 4- and 5-year scholarships. But that is rare. That is not the rule, but the exception. It's crazy.
Wow. So it was really you could look the wrong way at the coach, and the coach could decide he doesn't
see
like
ya.
You. See ya.
Right.
And you're twisting in the wind.
And then if you transfer, you got to sit out a year. So meanwhile, your coach can break his contract, jump to Washington or whatever, mm-hmm. and he's coaching right away. He's not sitting out. So it is insane. The transfer rule makes no sense. The scholarship rule makes no sense. Also, you have a practice called oversigning, where you're going to love this one.
Okay.
If you like the first two, you're going to love this one, Cindy. Here's how it goes.
Okay.
Down in the SEC mainly, they will offer 35 scholarships to players when they only have 25 to hand out. They bring you on campus in August before your freshman year and essentially run a tryout for all the players, and 10 of them obviously don't get scholarships. Now you're screwed because Vanderbilt's pulled their offer. LSU's pulled their offer.
You've said no to everybody else.
Exactly. They've got their players. So now you're totally screwed. And again, if you transfer, guess what?
You
sit out a year.
Wow.
They've reduced that now to a limit of 28. But why do you allow them to screw 3 players a year instead of 10? That is not a moral stance.
Is that across the board or more in the SEC?
It's done more often in the SEC, but the rule is across the board. You can oversign up to 28, so 3 extra. The good news is for the Big Ten fans is the Big Ten is very good on almost all these fronts. The SEC really is not.
Okay. What do you believe is going to happen? Now, the kids have voted at Northwestern, but it's sealed until?
The Northwestern University appeal mm-hmm. of the NLRB ruling gets settled. If they win the appeal, then the vote doesn't matter because you're not going to be a union.
Yeah.
If they lose the appeal, then the vote does matter. But this thing's going to be appealed up to the Supreme Court.
So expect this to go on for a long time.
That's the other issue. I think, in short, I think the players are asking for the right things.
Yes.
I'm not convinced that the union is the best way to ask for them.
Why?
Because it's Pandora's box. You open that up, you don't know what else is going to come out. And you might lose control of the process. The flip side argument, the union takes over, and they're going to ask for money sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And the players I talk to, most of them, that's not their point. But anyway, the flip side is, if you don't do this, then the NCAA tends not to listen to you. I mean, right now, they're already making some reforms pretty quickly based on this threat. The smart solution here,
yes,
and therefore it will not happen, because it never does in this milieu, the smart solution is for the NCAA to do the right thing before they have to. All right, guarantee scholarships to graduation. Guarantee health care for life of injury sustained while an athlete. End completely the practice of oversigning. Bonuses to ADs for what the athletes do. All these practices. Get rid of that, and these guys would probably drop their whole charge. If you fight this thing, mm-hmm. then you got to rally.
And have you had any conversations with anyone from the NCAA to be able to sit down and talk the way we are?
They have not returned any phone calls or emails over this several-year period. And I still fire them out there occasionally just, you know, for the heck of it, basically, to check that box. But no.
So,
and in fact, quite the opposite. Yeah. When Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, opens his mouth, he invariably makes it worse. Kane Coulter, the student running mm-hmm. this thing, is 10 times smarter than the guy defending it. And that often is the case these days, I've noticed.
And the answer that you give to people who you know will say, well, hey, these kids are getting free tuition. They're getting training and meals and travel. What more do they want?
And that's just my answers when I gave you. Look, that is true. And at Michigan, for the last book, 3 and Out, I calculated with the help of the CFO mm-hmm. that Michigan spends around $580,000 per 5-year out-of-state senior. All right, that's not chump change. They pay retail for out-of-state tuition, all this mm-hmm. stuff. That does not include strength and conditioning, tutoring, the coaching salaries, and all this other stuff. That is probably $750,000. For most athletes, that's a pretty good deal. Because very few of them are going to be NFL players.
Of course, understanding what the university is making off of that football team.
That's the flip side.
And it's certainly very disparate.
If you're a no-name lineman, you're getting a very good deal. If you're Donald Robinson, I guarantee you Michigan's making more off of you than you're making off Michigan.
What do you feel the chances are that athletes at a Michigan or a Michigan State or a Penn State are going to decide, hey, we want to get on board this train too?
It depends on how it goes, frankly. It depends also on how the NCAA responds. And again, if they're smart about it, tempers will cool down and we'll give you some very smart, sensible, moral things, in my opinion, and that'll probably be enough. If Mark Emmert keeps opening his mouth and saying things like, if we go in this direction, the whole thing will blow up, not realizing that's what a lot of people want, of course.
Or it is already.
Or it's going to, exactly. It's already blowing up. So also this ruling by the NLRB only applies right now to Northwestern in particular and private schools in general.
So that's just a tiny handful.
That's very few, about 10 or so that play big-time Division I football.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you, if Northwestern is forced to provide lifetime health care for their athletes, Michigan State will have to do it the next day or else they're going to lose players to Northwestern.
Fascinating discussion. What are you watching for next?
The crazy thing that's going to happen next.
Whatever it may be.
Right when you think you got a week off, you don't.
John Uvakin, as always, good talking with you. Thanks
Likewise.
So much.
Now that the Detroit Red Wings are going to get themselves a new home in 2016, in fact, they've begun tearing buildings down to make way for that new arena, Joe Louis Arena seems destined for the wrecking ball. And that is focusing fresh attention on Detroit's riverfront as the city searches for a new use for the riverfront site that was Joe Louis Arena. There could be some valuable lessons Detroit could learn from Buffalo. That's because Buffalo is doing more than just about any Great Lakes city to reconnect with its waterfront after generations of industrial abuse and neglect. Writer Edward McClellan wrote about this ongoing process of reclaiming Buffalo's waterfront in a story for Belt magazine. Edward McClellan, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, it's great to be back. I had one of my best interviews of my career on your show.
Well, thank you so much. You know, when we last spoke, we were talking to you about your book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Time, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. And I have to say, you really have a gift for making readers feel genuine emotions about a crumbling factory or a city that's left high and dry when its industry moves out, how heartbreaking it is. And in this story that you did for Belt Magazine, you start by taking us on literally a heartbreaking boat trip along Buffalo's waterfront in 2005. Give us an idea just how awful things were.
Well, that actually came from an earlier book I wrote, which is a book called The Third Coast, when I did the Great Lakes Circle Tour. I spent 3.5 months out on the road and visiting communities as far north as the top of Lake Superior and as far south as Buffalo and Detroit. And at that time, it really was... It was sort of science fiction-y. We were on the river, and really there was nothing in sight except these giant abandoned grain silos that had held grain at the time when Buffalo was the terminus on the Great Lakes, which, of course, it was a status it lost after the St. Lawrence Seaway opened. And once in a while, you'd see a fisherman or you'd see a heron, but it was just really empty. And I remember the guy who was on the boat saying there's very few things that Buffalo has done well, but one of them is isolating itself from its riverfront. And also at the time, the river was very polluted. Cleveland gets all the attention for its river catching fire, but Buffalo's river caught fire at one time during the 60s or the 70s too.
So here it is. It's the summer of 2005, and it's just, you know, desolate and polluted. So when did things start to get better? You know, we've all seen this story in the Rust Belt about industry pulls out and, you know, you and I, that's what we've talked about with your book, Nothing But Blue Skies. So when did the renaissance begin for Buffalo's lake and riverfront?
Well, it actually began in an area that they call the Inner Harbor, which is kind of taking the same name from Baltimore and kind of taking the same concept. And they started... They built a naval museum. They uncovered a short stretch of the original terminus of the Erie Canal, which was the reason that Buffalo became a big city in the first place. And it started kind of spreading up the river from there. And since then, they've had a developer who has built an outdoor hockey rink where they had a big tournament in February. He is actually moving into one of those old grain silos and building a restaurant and nightclub. And one interesting thing they did with the silos over the last summer, they've been projecting light shows on them. They're like giant movie screens. And the guy who took me on the tour back in 2005 was actually joking that I'm going to use these big white empty things as giant movie screens. And this brought a lot of people down to the waterfront. And another thing they did was they got it cleaned up. They got money from the EPA and from the state to dredge all the toxins out of the river.
So we get cleaner water, and also with these projects, Canalside and the Inner Harbor Project and the Outer Harbor Project, people are starting to say, wait, we can put some money in here and make it a leisure resource, but at the same time, it's a working waterway.
Yeah, it is. It's still a federally designated ship channel, although there's just not as much ship traffic as there used to be. General Mills is still there. They're still making Cheerios, so there's still some grain coming in and out. But really, there's just been a big shift in a lot of Great Lakes cities from the water as a conduit for industry to a lifestyle amenity. And unfortunately, a lot of places are sort of burdened with these old factories, with these highways that cut off the water from the public.
And certainly there's been a lot of conversation about Detroit's riverfront, and things are happening, as you know, with our Riverwalk and the Riverfront Conservancy working very, very hard. What lessons and what can you compare and contrast the Buffalo story with Detroit's river story?
I would say, first of all, Detroit does have some advantages over Buffalo. Number one, the Detroit River was never really the industrial conduit. That a lot of that went on the Rouge River, so that drew it off. So you don't have, when the steel would come into Ford, it would come in up the Rouge River.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a lot of that cluttering up the lakefront. I think it was more commercial activity there. And another is, for a city that has been criticized for highwaying itself to death, there really is not a highway going right along the riverfront. So there is more of an opportunity for open land there. I mean, Buffalo's biggest problem is Interstate 190, which was placed there in the 50s by Robert Moses.
The urban planner, and yes.
The urban planner. And there's a saying that Robert Moses' dead gray hands are still strangling the city of Buffalo. And this highway runs right along the Niagara River. And sometimes literally they'll have 100 feet between the highway and the river, and they'll have these little patches of grass, which is what passes for a riverfront park in Buffalo. And then they have the Skyway, which sort of overarches where the Buffalo River empties out into Lake Erie,
mm-hmm.
and it casts a big shadow there. So those are two things that Detroit really does have going for it that Buffalo doesn't have going for it. I guess the disadvantage is, it's a river. It's not as exciting as a lake. And the commercial activity was built up pretty close to the water, so there isn't a lot of room to work with, although there is more room than Buffalo has to work with.
Well, thinking of what you've learned from studying what's happened in Buffalo with its waterfront, you've got this Rust Belt city that transformed its waterways from polluted industrial resources to, as you put it very well, fishable, swimmable, kayakable lifestyle amenities. So looking ahead to the future, what did you find that gives you hope of new directions for Rust Belt cities like Buffalo and like Detroit?
Well, Buffalo and Detroit and even Chicago. In Chicago, they just opened a new space for what's supposed to be on the old U.S. Steel site, which was the last piece of undeveloped land on Lake Michigan. And it's supposed to be a new housing development with up to 17,000 housing units, which is sort of going to revive the South Side, which has never really recovered from the Rust Belt era, unlike the rest of Chicago. I mean, what gives me hope is that people are seeing that water is not just something to float ships on or to empty industrial effluent into. It's not just a highway or a toilet. It's a lifestyle amenity, and people want to live near the water. And I think in a lot of places you're seeing partnerships between the private sector and the cities and the states and the federal government to clean it up and to make space for people to get closer to the water.
Edward McClellan's his story, Remaking Buffalo's Waterfront, Lessons for the Rest of the Rust Belt, appeared in Belt Magazine. And, of course, he is the author of Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Time, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Ted, and I hope we do it again soon.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cindy.
Welcome back to Stateside. Education, poverty, our economy, our quality of life. There are so many issues on the minds of Michigan voters as we look ahead to the November elections. The Center for Michigan has been listening to what voters are saying, and the result is
Michigan Speaks, the Citizens' Agenda for the 2014 election. It's being released today. And here to tell us just what Michigan voters are thinking about, worrying about, and hoping for is Phil Power. He's the founder of the Center for Michigan. It's so good to have you with us.
Well, it's nice to be here. Your show is a great compliment to the station, and it's a great help to people in Michigan.
Well, thank you so very much. And also joining Phil is the president and the CEO of the Center for Michigan, John Bebo. Good to have you back on Stateside.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So, Phil, I'm going to start with you. What is the mood of voters in Michigan?
Mood of the voters is actually better than you might imagine. They are, to a degree, optimistic and hopeful that the state is going to get better. They're hopeful but not wildly enthused about what's coming up. The one thing that is very striking as we come out of this ferocious winter is a very strong preference among almost all people who participated in our community conversations. That's 5,500 people over the last 5 months. Their major priority is fix the roads. Surprise, they're willing to pay a little more to get the roads fixed. And that is a big surprise for anybody who pays attention to Lansing and all the cries, oh, let's cut taxes, let's do this and that. About the time you do a front-end alignment and change a tire, you recognize the old line, you pay me now or you pay me later.
So this is an across-the-board kind of thing, John?
Yeah, we saw in both our conversations and our polls and across the various worker groups and race groups and income groups that we measure, the support is there for roads and for a roads fix. That's on the agenda in Lansing right now. There's talk about finally having a vote on that. And in fact, we moved up the release of this report because we heard rumblings in Lansing that the road issue might finally be front burner. And we saw what the public was saying, and we didn't want these voices to be on the sidelines as that was getting debated.
Phil, what else did the center find that matters to you?
Well, the other biggest finding is people are very unhappy and worried about how much it costs to go to college. As you know, and as a lot of your audience knows, the big movement in prices in America over the last 10 years has been the increase in college tuition. And a lot of people have been worried about it, but our findings, both in the poll and in the community conversations, people are grumpy, and they think that college education is costing a lot of money. They're not clear why, but it seems to have something to do with the amount of student debt that kids are accumulating. And if you think about it, you graduate from school, you got $50,000 worth of debt. Are you likely to start a new little company when you come out with a great idea and you got 50 grand lying on your back? Nah.
And might you stay in Michigan or might you head to, let's say, a secure job offer in Chicago?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a big problem. And we at the center, we think that this is something that needs to be very carefully looked at over the coming months. We're probably next year, going to be looking at the needs of the labor force, what is being produced by the colleges, community colleges, and high schools, and how it is that the supply of talent relates to the demand from employers and from the economy. And it's pretty clear that if you look at the unemployment numbers, that there's something not connected there.
There's something's out of sync, right, John?
Yeah. And speaking of out of sync, there's been a lot of policy work and debate on education in Lansing over the past 4 years.
Sure has.
And education is a huge topic again this year with the public. But this college affordability issue has not been front burner, has not been right in the middle of the radar screen in Lansing.
K through 12 seems to get a lot, suck up a lot of oxygen in the education discussion.
K-12 does suck up a lot of oxygen, but what we're seeing from the public this year is they're not seeing results yet from all of the reform hash and rehash of the past few years. Student performance is still an urgent concern of citizens across the state. And this college affordability issue, it's a big consumer issue, and that is not being debated hotly, heavily, and with a lot of different alternative ways to fix it in the state capitol right now.
Well, in fact, as you talk to voters, Phil, do people have ideas? Do they offer up ideas with what needs to be done, or do we just have a pretty good sense they're grumpy about it?
to some degree, there's a splintering of opinion when you everybody says we don't like tuition because it's too high. Okay, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
Some people say, and I think with some justice, the reason that tuition is so high is the state has cut back on support for public colleges and universities. We've cut maybe 30% over the last 5 years, and that's a lot of money, and it really hits people. On the other hand, a lot of people say colleges and universities are luxurious. Lots of professors don't teach full time. Lots of administrators, too many administrators, too high salaries. Why are we spending all this money on athletic facilities? Mm-hmm. And so it's a mixed picture, but it's clear two things come, at least to my mind. The first is people, as expressed in our community conversations, are very worried about their futures in the job market. Unemployment remains high. People with not very many skills don't get good jobs. And people want to see how it is that things can get better. And that drives all the discussion of K-12 in Lansing, which we've heard. And we think that it's likely to drive discussion of colleges and universities in the days to come. And I think what people are saying in this report is candidates for statewide office and for the legislature need to be on the same page as the electorate. And somebody who comes in and says, well, who cares about the roads? I want to cut taxes. People are going to say, wait a minute, Clyde. We want the roads fixed, and you better come along with the course here.
And poverty, John, was on many minds.
Yeah, surprisingly so. I think the rawness over college affordability was higher than I think we would have anticipated. And I think the awareness of poverty issues is also surprising. You know, we journalists have been writing about poverty and talking about poverty for a long time. There's 1.5 million people in poverty in Michigan. That consciousness has reached across all communities now. We see rich, poor, black, white, full-time employed workers, retirees, and the unemployed all saying, hey, this poverty thing is a pretty big deal. It's not just isolated to people in poverty being concerned about poverty anymore. The great quandary, though, is what to do about it. People are worried about it. People don't have a lot of solutions to the situation right now, although they point toward the great hope being better education. All of this logic is somewhat circular. It brings us
right back
to the education policy debates we're having, and it brings us right back to college affordability. So that was, the poverty issue was, I think, a surprise for us. I don't think we would have predicted that it is reaching the levels of consciousness that it is.
If you're a concerned citizen, John, what do you think the challenge is for people who care, and you certainly had no shortage of them being part of this? What's their challenge?
Well, I think part of the challenge is to hold candidates accountable when they come knocking on your door or calling on your phone. And I think there's a way to sift through some of the pretenders this year, and it's on the pocketbook issue of taxes. There will no doubt be candidates who come out knocking on your door saying they're going to cut taxes. There will be others who will promise the sky and the moon and the planet Venus if you elect them, but they won't have any way to pay for it. And part of the wisdom of the public in this report is we're seeing kind of a new normal on tax policy. People, there's no public mandate to cut taxes more. And I'm not afraid to come on your show and tell you there's no public mandate to keep cutting taxes. Likewise, there's no public mandate to raise taxes. So we would encourage the media this year to look carefully at the results on the tax and budget questions in this report, because that's the first shortcut that candidates will take in their brochures that they leave on your doorstep. I'm going to cut taxes. Well, wait a minute. Where's the public mandate to do it? Or I'm going to deliver 38 new government programs. Well, where's the public mandate to raise the money for that? We're kind of operating in a new normal where the current structure of the tax system and the revenues available are probably what the public appetite is based on what we see in our results here. That means in order to do some of the things the public wants, things are going to have to be done differently. There were going to be ongoing fights about how to spend the money we have, how to tax people. That's what makes, we think, the road news especially headline-grabbing, because it is an area where people are willing to pay more. That's how urgent this is. They want it fixed.
There's so much in this. The Michigan Speaks, the Citizens Agenda for the 2014 elections being released today. And you can go to the website for the Center for Michigan, which is thecenterformichigan.net. And I know you'll be – it goes without saying that I know disseminating this to our policymakers in Lansing has got to be a top priority, getting the word out. But citizens who are concerned will do very well to go and check out Michigan Speaks, the Citizens Agenda for the 2014 elections. And it's been a pleasure talking with Phil Power, the founder of the Center for Michigan. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thanks very much for having us.
And the president and CEO of the Center for Michigan, John Bebo. Always good to have both of you on the program.
It's always a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
There's some pretty unsettling data that's come out about the health of the people in the Upper Peninsula. The Centers for Disease Control report that heart attack rates for the entire western and eastern UP for 2008 through 2010 are at the highest level of the top five categories of heart disease and stroke. So what does all of this say about health care and health habits in the UP? And what can bring the high rates down? I'm joined now by Dr. Teresa Frankovic. She's the medical director for the Western Upper Peninsula Health Department that covers the region from the western UP to Marquette County. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much.
Can you give us a deeper idea of what these CDC figures are telling us, basically about the chances of dying of a heart attack or heart disease if I live in the Upper Peninsula?
Well, actually, the statistics are rather interesting. When you look at what the CDC has put out recently on this, the numbers on first pass look rather dramatic for poor outcomes and high rates of cardiovascular disease in the western UP. However, the data that you're referring to is not age-adjusted. And in fact, when you adjust for the fact that the population in the Upper Peninsula is typically much older than it is when you look at the rest of the state, our numbers look very much like the state of Michigan overall.
Interesting. Well, the state of Michigan certainly has shares lifestyle factors, obesity being one of them, right?
Exactly. And, you know, when we look at that, when you look at cardiovascular disease in Michigan overall, it's certainly the number one cause of death. And, you know, we're about the eighth worst in the country in terms of looking at that. So about one of three deaths in Michigan are secondary to cardiovascular disease. And the UP looks much like that.
Talk to us, if you could, about how the high death rate from heart attacks and heart disease is tied into the challenges of rural poverty. I'm wondering what these day-to-day challenges and situations are that people face that contribute to their risk.
Well, when we look at, you know, heart disease in general, we know that, you know, the major modifiable risk factors are tobacco use is one of the top. And, you know, we know that when we look at tobacco use in the UP, about half of the UP adults are current or former smokers. And when you look at people who have less than a high school education, we're talking about 41% of people current smokers. So, you know, that certainly is contributing to cardiovascular disease rates. We also know that in modifiable risk factors, physical inactivity, diabetes, obesity, are all important factors. And, you know, there are certain challenges when you look at the Upper Peninsula compared to some other regions. The fact that it's still snowing today is one of them. So we look at physical inactivity. It's a problem nationally and in the state, as well as locally, that people are not as active as they should be. And when you have the challenges of a climate in which you might have snow on the ground 6 to 7 months out of the year, and large distances between places where you always jump in a car to go somewhere, you know, you can see that physical inactivity becomes a problem.
And speaking of large distances, I would have to say when I saw those statistics, one of my first thoughts tended toward the, well, gee, people tend to live further away from cities when you live in the UP. So if I'm living in Covington or Twin Lakes, I've got quite a haul to the nearest large hospital if I'm having chest pains.
Well, that's very true. I mean, certainly a major barrier in the UP is healthcare access, and that has to do with geography because, again, we're talking about, you know, the UP is, you know, about a third of the land area of Michigan, but we've got about 3% of the population. So people are spread far and wide. There's one larger regional medical center, but in the western UP counties, you know, that regional center where there are cardiologists on staff staff and interventional cardiologists there. You know, for many people, that distance may be more than 100 miles. So you count on small rural hospitals for stabilization and transport to address some of those issues.
I guess I'm wondering, as a public health physician, what do you take away from these figures, and what does it tell you about what needs to happen in the way that we deliver health care?
There are certain things that can be addressed by, you know, for instance, a larger physician population to serve the community. But when we did a recent community health assessment across the five counties that constitute the Western UP District, you know, the biggest predictors we saw for poor health outcomes were poverty and low educational attainment. Those are the best predictors for poor health status. When we look at our area, we look at things like, you know, how do we address, you know, sort of policy and infrastructure to change health outcomes. I think traditionally public health has had a focus on educating individuals, and I think what we've come to realize over time is that in order to have healthier people, we need to change the communities in which they live.
And the idea of moving from diagnosis and treatment to a prevention thrust.
Absolutely. I mean, we know it's really well established that prevention is the best bang for your buck. And yet it's very hard to move the healthcare system to prevention. So really we've been working in a lot of the UP on things to essentially change the communities. Rather than trying to move the healthcare system at the moment. So we're looking at things like developing complete streets ordinances so we accommodate pedestrians and cyclists. We're working on non-motorized transportation plans. We're working on safe routes to school, community gardens, food exchanges that bring small farmers and vendors together to maximize what we can get in terms of fresh fruits and vegetables. We're working on farm-to-school programs, all of those things to try and help change the environment a bit where people are living.
The view towards public health and fighting heart disease from the snow-covered Upper Peninsula. Dr. Terry Frankovich is the medical director for the Western Upper Peninsula Health Department. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and we want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Sade, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.